Welcome to Abnormalcy. I'm Todd Robbins. This is a podcast of true tales featuring the disquietly strange, the distressingly unusual, the unnervingly bizarre, and the maliciously beautiful. These unsettling stories are not for everyone, and yet they might be just right for you. Welcome. San Francisco is a great town. When I was a kid, it was the city that we went to for vacations and to visit some relatives that lived nearby. Later on, I lived there, and that was a wonderfully happy time in my life. One of the reasons for this was because San Francisco was filled with character, and much of that character was of a very shady nature. That's the way the city by the bay always has been. I haven't been back there for many, many years, and I hear the gates of the city have been stormed by soulless folks that, emboldened by their vast wealth, made up of tainted and greasy Silicon Valley money, they have reimagined the city to suit their vapid sensibilities. This saddens me, and yet it is hoped that one day, after all that money has been spent, the true flavor of San Francisco will once again emerge like a sprout of a tree growing out of a crack in a cement sidewalk. Allow me to wax nostalgic for some of the murkier elements that made San Francisco such a great town in the past. First off, the town wasn't always known as San Francisco. The original name was Yerba Buena. For those of you that are linguistically challenged, that name is Spanish for the good weed. And there are many that will tell you that the good weed in that name is the good weed of which you think. Though the much more respectable name of San Francisco was settled upon, named after the town's Spanish mission of St. Francis, it has been known by a number of other names. Most residents just refer to it as the city. And there was a time that that was the only address needed if you wanted a letter to get to San Francisco. The late columnist Herb Cain christened it Baghdad by the Bay and meant it as a good thing. My favorite nickname was given to it by President Taft when he visited the city in 1910 and was impressed at how quickly San Francisco had rebuilt after the devastating earthquake and fire of 1906. He called it the city that knows how. Whatever you do, don't call it San Fran or Frisco. That's the surest way to show off that you are an outsider, and also to get from the natives there anything from a dirty look to a punch in the nose, depending upon who you say it to. Gold was discovered just inland from San Francisco in 1849, and that changed everything. Almost overnight, the city went from a sleepy little village to a throbbing metropolis. From the very beginning, San Francisco has been a bit different from other towns. There is a quirkiness to the place, and more than a little darkness. It has always embraced those that were a bit different from the norm, whether it be the hippies that started the flower power movement of the 1960s, or the Jim Jones church that ended so badly, or the gay community that seems to have always been part of San Francisco, even long before it was accepted elsewhere in the country. And there are a number of outstanding characters that added so much to the city through the years. First and foremost is Joshua Abraham Norton. He was born in 1818 in England and raised in South Africa and came to San Francisco in 1849 and after the death of his parents. He was a successful commodities trader. Unfortunately, though, he speculated in the rice shortage in China and lost everything. By 1859, he was living in a shabby rooming house. Something in him seemed to have snapped late in the summer of 1859. And on September of that year, he strolled into the editorial offices of each of the newspapers. He was resplendent in a regal uniform that consisted of a long military coat with epaulets upon each shoulder, a tarnished saber, and a gray top hat festooned with an ostrich feather. He was there to deliver a letter to the editors in which proclaimed himself Emperor of the United States. Later on, when Napoleon III invaded Mexico, he added Protector of Mexico to his title. Remarkably, all of San Francisco went along with his outlandish claim and treated him like royalty. When his uniform started to show some wear and tear, he showed up at a meeting of the Board of Supervisors and demanded that they buy him a new one. They did. Emperor Norton I would stroll all over town, often with children and stray dogs following him, and would stand on street corners making proclamations. One of them called for the disbanding of Congress due to the corruption he found there. In the 1870 census, his occupation is listed as emperor, and there is an added note, a single word, insane. When Norton died in 1880, more than 10,000 people lined the funeral route. and he was given a military burial with full honors. Two of those stray dogs that followed Norton around were celebrities in their own right. They were the dogs Bummer and Lazarus. Bummer was the older of the two and gained a great renown for being a rat killer. He got his name from bumming scraps of food wherever he went. Bummer once saved another smaller dog that was being attacked by a much bigger dog. The small dog was seriously wounded in the fight, and no one thought it would survive. The story goes that Bummer brought food to the wounded friend and coaxed him to eat. Eventually, the dog regained his health and thereafter became a constant companion to Bummer. Because he basically rose from the dead, the dog was christened Lazarus. When a new dog catcher grabbed Lazarus, an angry mob descended upon him and demanded the dog be released. The two dogs were declared property of the city of San Francisco and were exempt from any anti-stray dog laws of the town. At some point, the two dogs discovered that Emperor Norton was welcomed in all saloons and allowed to eat from the free lunch buffet. They followed him wherever he went. Emperor Norton not only gorged himself on the victuals he found there, he made sure that his canine companions were well fed. They became such a part of the character of the city that all the theatrical productions that opened in San Francisco made sure that three tickets for the opening night in the front row of the balcony were set aside for them. The two dogs eventually met their demise. Lazarus was the first to go, followed by Bummer 2 years later. The eulogy for Bummer was written by Mark Twain. These two curs were so well known and beloved, they were both stuffed and resided for many years in the Golden Gate Park Museum. A brass plaque commemorating their lives can be found next to the Transamerica Pyramid. Emperor Norton had a rival when it came to being San Francisco's resident eccentric. His name was Frederick Coombs, though few in the city knew him by that name. He was a phrenologist by trade, someone that reads the bumps on people's heads and can prognosticate their past, present, and future. Before settling in San Francisco, Coombs traveled the West presenting demonstrations of this science, accompanied by a giant and a dwarf. Once he settled in San Francisco, his entertaining performances of cranial divination became a favorite of the societal movers and shakers. People often remark how much Professor Coombs resembled George Washington, so much so that one day Coombs seemed to go off the deep end and insist thereafter he was George Washington. The fact that Washington had been dead for more than 50 years didn't seem to bother him or anyone else, and the public went along with it, referring to him as George Washington II. He would sit in a saloon attired in a Revolutionary Army uniform, powdered wig, and tri-cornered hat, going over maps, planning various battles. Apparently, during the winter, he would rarely eat, thinking that he was encamped at Valley Forge. One reporter commented that Coombs had the light of insanity in his eyes. Coombs rubbed Emperor Norton the wrong way, and when the press asked Coombs why Norton hated him, Coombs, who was rather fat and balding, replied that Norton was jealous of his reputation with the fairer sex. The press had a field day with this, and it enraged Emperor Norton, who issued a proclamation to the chief of police that George Washington II must be arrested and institutionalized. Coombs quickly made a hasty retreat, left town, headed to New York, where he could be seen entertaining ladies on the street corners by showing off his legs. Men do not have a monopoly on the nuttiness in San Francisco. One of the most remarkable of the peculiar people was Lily Hancock Coit, better known as Firebell Lil. She was born into a wealthy family and moved to San Francisco as a young girl in the early 1850s. The defining moment of her life occurred in 1858 when she was 15 years old. She saw a bunch of firefighters responding to a blaze. There was something about watching these burly men in their bright red shirts and elaborate helmets straining to extinguish the flames that excited her imagination. These firefighters were short-handed, so she jumped in to help. The fellows were impressed with this teenage girl, possibly in several ways, and made her their mascot of their fire brigade. They liked having her around, even though she was a member of the upper class and well-known in polite society, and she liked being around these rough-and-tumble fellows. Later on, she enjoyed drinking with them, smoking cigars with them, gambling with them, and probably doing other things with them as well. When she attended high society functions, Lily always wore upon her Parisian silk ball gown a gold badge given to her by the Knickerbocker Engine Company. She was made an honorary member in appreciation for all she did for firefighters. There's a story that at her wedding reception, when a fire brigade was heard racing to respond to a fire alarm, she grabbed her helmet and ran to join them. San Franciscans thought nothing of seeing Lily dress as a man, placing bets in one of the men's-only gambling halls in the North Beach area. She was one of the boys. Upon her death in 1929, she bequeathed money that was used to erect Coit Tower upon the top of Telegraph Hill. The tower is a tribute to all brave firefighters, especially those that fought the blaze that leveled the city after the 1906 earthquake. Officially, it is said that the design of the tower was inspired by the nozzle of a fire hose. Unofficially, many feel that the design was inspired by a different kind of fireman's nozzle. Lily would be very happy. Now, I know that you're thinking that all of this is quite fun, but where is the murder and mayhem? I'm coming to it. However, before I do, allow me to tell you about one more quirky fellow. Don't worry, there's violence in his tale. He was known as Oofty Goofty. Of course, that wasn't his real name. He was born Leonard Borchardt in Berlin in 1862. When he was 14 years old, Leon, as he was called, stowed away on a ship, was caught, and pressed into service. After working off his punishment by toiling away on several Atlantic crossings, he jumped ship in 1878. He made his way around the country, living on the streets, and finally enlisted in the U.S. Army. He was a runty little fellow, about 5'4", and had curly black hair and a dark complexion. Because he was Jewish, he was mercilessly harassed by his fellow soldiers. He was deployed to the Washington Territory out west to fight Native Americans. There he deserted, was caught, and then escaped again. He made his way to San Francisco, and he walked into a sideshow down on Market Street. He desperately needed a job and told the owner of the show that he would do anything. That showman put him to the test by making him play the role of the wild man of Borneo. He was locked in a large cage, made to jump around, growl, devour raw, rancid meat, and shout, "Oofty goofty, oofty goofty, oofty goofty," over and over and over. In order to make him more fearful, they covered his body in horsehair. In order to make that hair stick, they first covered his body in molten tar. It was extremely painful, but Leon was happy to have a job. It didn't last long. After about a week, he collapsed and almost died. That tar kept his skin from breathing and sweating. Leon, or Oofty Goofy as he was now known, was rushed to the hospital, and the only way they could get the tar off of him was to soak him in a vat of caustic solvent and then make him sit out in the boiling sun on the roof of the hospital. Little by little, the tar was peeled off of him, along with much of his skin. The whole ordeal was excruciatingly painful, and the agony Oofty Goofty went through desensitized him to pain. This led him to the next phase of his career. After he was released from the hospital, he went back to living on the streets. He was forcibly thrown out of a saloon in the Barbary Coast area, and when he landed with a thunk upon the hard cobblestone street, he discovered that it didn't hurt. This gave him an idea. Knowing firsthand how cruel his fellow man could be, he decided to make a buck off of it. Soon he became well known for strolling into saloons with a baseball bat in his hand. He made a proposition to the patrons there. They could kick him for 5 cents, smack him with a walking stick for 15 cents, or beat him with that baseball bat for 25 cents. The scheme lasted for a few years until one night in 1891, a large man took him up on his offer. The guy picked up a pool cue and whacked Oofty Goofty in the back. That man was the legendary heavyweight boxing champion of the world, John L. Sullivan. The blow fractured 3 vertebrae in Oofty's spine, and he walked with a limp thereafter. Oofty Goofty was so well known that he was able to parlay his fame into various other forms of entertainment. People found his portrayal of Romeo in Romeo and Juliet memorable. It was a parody of the Shakespeare play, and his Juliet was a 300-pound burlesque dancer named Big Bertha. Oofty Goofty ate very well, thanks to the vegetables people threw at him while he performed. One day, Oofty Goofty took part in a long-distance walking race. He strolled out of San Francisco and was never seen there again. San Francisco has always been a town filled with people coming to live there from somewhere else. It started with the Spanish, and it's continued on to this day with people from all over the world trekking there to make their fame and fortune with the next big dot-com empire. Through the years, significant communities of German, Irish, Italian, Russian, and other foreign-born folks have sprung up in San Francisco. Of particular interest to me is the Chinese community. There's much intrigue found there. In the world of the traveling circus, there's often a clause in a performer's contract that requires them, in addition to doing their acts in the show, to also do a bit of heavy lifting, setting up the tent and other equipment, and this laborious work is known in circus slang as doing Chinese. And there's a very good reason for it. Chinese men were imported from China to the western parts of the United States in order to do jobs such as working in mines and building the railroads. These were the low-paying jobs that no one else wanted to do. They were hard, hard jobs, with long, grueling hours and a goodly deal of danger, too. Because of the differences in culture and language, these Chinese immigrants tended to group together among themselves and have very few dealings with Westerners. This created an environment of misunderstanding and mistrust of the Chinese. Many Westerners looked upon the Chinese as barely human. They mistreated them and persecuted them. In San Francisco, the Chinese settled all together in one part of the city. It became known as Chinatown and still exists to this day. It's always been isolated, and though seemingly very gracious to outsiders, it is only open on the surface to those not part of the community. Chinatown is very much a city within a city. When it came to the Chinese, Westerners made it a one-way street. Starting in 1882, Chinese Exclusion Acts were made into law, and these limit immigration to those people that could be of use to the movers and shakers of Western society. Primarily, single men were welcomed and families were not allowed to come from China. Also, there was a law that made it illegal for a Chinese man to marry a non-Chinese woman. Lawmakers couldn't have that kind of thing happening in their land of the free. So this created a problem. You had all these Chinese men and few Chinese women. Something needed to be done about that. As we know, whenever restrictions are set up, there are those that find a great deal of profit in violating those restrictions. In the San Francisco Chinese community, a lovely human trafficking syndicate sprung up that smuggled in young Chinese women. Many of them had been kidnapped in China, covertly shipped over to the U.S., and became sex slaves in secret brothels in Chinatown. Many of them were only girls, hadn't even gone through puberty. Women captured and put into this hellish situation had a life expectancy of 5 years. Enter into the situation a vibrant young woman named Donalina Cameron. She was not Chinese. She was born in New Zealand and grew up in California. She began her association with a Presbyterian mission house in 1888 when she was 19 years old. She came there to teach sewing to the young Asian women that had been saved by the mission. The mission was located at 920 Sacramento Street, and that majestic old building was a safe haven for the few brave Chinese women that attempted to escape this dreadful lives that they had been forced into. Donalina became filled with a burning desire to do something about the plight of these forgotten Chinese women, not only the ones that walked through the doors of the mission, but also the ones trapped and hidden away by the criminal syndicates in Chinatown known as the Tongs. Her exploits would make for a wonderful action movie. From her spies and informants in Chinatown, she would receive information about women being kept in secret rooms and homes, or in covert brothels hidden behind false storefronts, or with unmarked entrances at the end of dark alleyways. Cameron would make daring raids, racing across rooftops, scaling ladders, climbing down into basements, sometimes with the assistance of police, sometimes with hired detectives, sometimes just by herself. It was very difficult and very dangerous. Those Chinese gangs, the Tongs, had henchmen and bodyguards that would try and stop her. But she learned self-defense techniques to protect herself and was not averse to using weapons. And sometimes the battles would continue after the raids were over. The Tongs would often come to the mission house and reclaim their property. And these encounters would get violent. It is estimated that she freed several thousand Chinese women. However, she undertook these perilous raids not only to liberate these trapped women, but also for the greater good of God. You see, Donalina Cameron was not only a social crusader, she was also a religious one as well. And it was her obsession to convert these heathen women she rescued to Christianity, whether they wanted to be converted or not. When the 1906 earthquake and the fire that followed hit San Francisco, Cameron not only got all of the women staying of the mission house out alive and saw them delivered to a safe location outside of the city, she also returned and braved the flames to save all the documents that identified the women and told who they were. In the chaos of the aftermath of the earthquake, some devious fellows in the Chinese community tried to make a grab for these women, claiming they were missing wives and sisters. That didn't work. When the fire was out and the rubble cleared, the city started to rebuild. The mission house had been dynamited by the military troops that had been deployed to help fight the fire. They blew up many buildings in the hopes of creating a fire break. That didn't work, and it needlessly destroyed many historic buildings, including the Mission House. The Mission House was rebuilt using many of the bricks from the original building, but the new house had a new design. Donalena Cameron had learned a thing or two during those raids about hiding people, so she had secret rooms built into the basement. This way, when the Tongs broke into the building, the women they were looking for were nowhere to be found. These rooms had secret locked entryways, locks to which only Donalena had the key. There was no way of getting into or out of these rooms once they were secured. This seemed like a good idea, until the night a fire broke out in the building. That fire, of suspicious origins, swept through the Mission House, and those Chinese women in those secret rooms were trapped. They were consumed by the smoke and flames. Today, that basement area is locked up, and the entryway is secured with red and gold chains. The Chinese believe these chains will ward off the vengeful spirits of the dead. However, that basement area is locked up for another reason. Other dark events occurred there. Donalena Cameron retired from her duties of running the Presbyterian Mission House in the late 1930s. Soon thereafter, the Mission House was renamed in her honor. About a decade later, in 1947, Reverend F. S. Weichman took over as the director of the organization. He was a kindly man that insisted people call him Dick. The Cameron House expanded its purpose and became a community center, helping those in need. Reverend Weichman made sure the young women coming there were safe. The young boys that came there, well, not so much. It has been reported that for 30 years, this director sexually abused a countless number of Chinese boys and young men. These Asian males came from a culture that insisted upon unquestioning respect for their elders and people of authority. These boys and young men did whatever the Reverend F. S. Dick Weichman asked them to do, and what he asked them to do was irreprehensible. He also demanded that they tell no one, and for 3 decades they didn't, and the abuse continued. But in 1977, someone did speak out. The Reverend was removed from his position and hidden away in a retirement home out of town. After the investigation and lawsuits, the Cameron House recovered and continues on to this day, providing service to the Asian community of San Francisco. There is, however, one curious program listed on their website. They have created a, quote, safe space for young Asian women. The name of this program is the darkly ironic, quote, Girls on Fire. I know what you're saying. What about awful, gruesome death? We didn't come here for delightful whimsy. All right, calm down. Don't get your shroud in a twist. I got your darkness right here. Where to begin? There's been so much deadly depravity in this city through the years. With all the gold flowing through town starting in 1849, you know that there have been many, many bad people doing many, many bad things. Before the discovery of gold, San Francisco had a population of 800. Within a year or two, 25,000 people were living there. There were growing pains. Down by the waterfront, there bloomed an area known as the Barbary Coast. This was an area of town that raged for decades. You could find any kind of vice you wanted there, and many kinds you wouldn't want. I could do a whole episode on this sinister area, and I think I will in the future, along with visiting other glorious evil vice districts such as New Orleans' Storyville, Chicago's Levee, and New York's Tenderloin District. But I digress. Let's get back to San Francisco. The social commentator, author Hinton Helper, wrote, "I have seen purer liquors, better cigars, finer tobacco, truer guns and pistols, larger dirks and bowie knives, and prettier women courtesans here in San Francisco than in any other place I have ever visited. California can and does furnish the best bad things that are obtainable in America." In an environment like this, things can get out of hand. Many a fellow strolled into saloons in San Francisco and were never seen again, and the police and elected officials did nothing to stop it. These became so bad that in 1851, the people of San Francisco rose up, formed what was known as the Committee of Vigilance. 700 prominent citizens joined this vigilante group. It was very well organized, with bylaws that were voted upon in secret, and a proclamation that the government in San Francisco was a failure and that this committee was now in charge and that they would clean up the town. And clean it up they did after quite a bit of blood was spilt. They took matters into their own hands, running many well-known thieves and grifters out of town by force and quickly hanging 4 men accused of murder. Their actions shook things up and sent a very clear message to the rogues, thugs, and miscreants of the town that there would be no business as usual in San Francisco. What is remarkable about this incident is that history shows us that when citizens take the law into their own hands, it can often get out of control and create problems far greater than the ones inspired the need for vigilantism. In this case, however, almost everything seemed to work out as planned. The crime rate went down, the city was safer, and by the end of 1852, the Committee for Vigilance disbanded. Of course, the good times didn't last. Those members of the committee would become elected officials and worked hard to run the city on the straight and narrow. But, you see, corruption in San Francisco is deeply seated. And after the committee formally disbanded, these malevolent, self-serving politicians creep back out from under the rocks where they'd been hiding and resume their practices of raping and pillaging the town for personal profit. Corrupt elections led to officials gaining power that allowed political favors to be doled out to the highest bidders. Many nefarious and deadly means were used to ensure that the gravy train never stopped. It all came to a head on May 14, 1856, when a bottom feeder politician named James Casey, fed up with the constant meddling from a reform-minded newspaper man named James King, murdered that muckraking editor and writer. After King's murder, Casey smugly turned himself in, calmly convinced that his corrupt cronies would merely slap him on the wrist for his crimes and privately pat him on the back for taking care of that nuisance. James Casey was dead wrong. Having done this once before, the citizens of San Francisco quickly sprang into action. They approached William T. Coleman, one of the original members of the Committee of Vigilance, and urged him to lead the call to arms. Coleman was a bit weary from his years of fighting the endless corruption, but he rose to the challenge and things quickly fell into place for a renewed cleansing and a vow to do anything required to bring it about. Anything. This group enlisted a seasoned military man named Charles Doan to be in charge of the armed aspects of this righteous rebellion. With glee, Doan took over a warehouse on Sacramento Street, loaded it up with cannons and other armaments, fortified it with sandbags, and turned this industrial building into a mighty fortress and base of operation for training and deploying his ad hoc army. Though the shady leaders were taken by surprise with the rapidity of this armed response, they didn't take it lying down. They marshaled the police force and rounded up all the guns for hire hoodlums they could in order to attack the warehouse. A mighty battle ensued, but the efforts of these lowlifes were in vain. They were defeated. Just as before, but with a tinge more vengeance fueled by the desire to clean up things once and for all, the vigilantes went to work. They started off by breaking into the jail and kidnapping that murderer, James Casey, and another criminal. They brought them to the Sacramento warehouse, gave them a trial, a fair one, and found them guilty. They hung these two in public. The message was very clear. The vigilantes prevailed in their holy quest, and things improved in San Francisco. It's interesting to note that since their efforts to physically defeat the vigilantes was unsuccessful, the crooked political leaders attempted to thwart the reformers legally with numerous lawsuits and claims of over $1 million in damages. Unfortunately for these immoral scoundrels, they'd been so brazen in their corruption, the courts found no validity in their claims, and they were soundly defeated. The vigilantes disbanded once again once their work was done, and though the conditions in the city improved, there was a lingering discontent and distrust floating through San Francisco. Yes, the city was cleaned up. However, it was done by the wealthier members of the community, and there was a feeling among many that there was now a ruling class in San Francisco, that the moneyed folks of the city were looking down upon the rest of the citizens, looking down both figuratively and literally from their new homes perched atop Knob Hill. That area, that neighborhood, was given the nickname Snob Hill. These class distinctions crumbled when that earthquake and fire rolled through the city in 1906. Since that disaster is well documented, let's focus on another natural disaster, an epidemic. A deadly disease erupted, an elected official downplayed its existence. The disease spread and people died needlessly. No, I'm not talking about the year 2020 and COVID-19. I'm referring to the outbreak of that golden oldie of all infectious diseases, the bubonic plague. And that outbreak happened in the Chinatown section of San Francisco back in the final years of the 19th century. The governor of California, Henry Gage, was told about the outbreak, but fearing that the news of this killer could have a negative impact on the golden reputation of his state, and more importantly, the business of his state, he did everything he could to eradicate it. No, not the disease, news of the disease. Like the proverbial ostrich, he stuck his head in the sand and denied there was a problem. This didn't help anyone, except the disease itself, which spread like, well, a plague. The plague reared its ugly head in China in the middle of the 19th century, killing 15 million people. There was a flare-up of it in Hong Kong in 1894, and then it spread from there. By the turn of the 20th century, it had reached Hawaii and was coming for the U.S., specifically San Francisco. The San Francisco Examiner ran a headlined article titled, "Why San Francisco is Plague-Proof." What a lovely bit of falder all that was. And there was a false belief that the Chinese ate rice and that's what made them succumb to the disease, whereas we Western meat-eaters were immune. That's adorable. What wasn't widely well known was that rats carried the plague and fleas on the rats could carry the disease to the human population. Therefore, when a ship from Asia came to San Francisco, the passengers were checked for the disease. But no attention was paid to the rats scurrying down the mooring line ropes from the ship to the docks, docks that were very near the sewers that ran to Chinatown. The plague took hold in Chinatown, and the area was quarantined. However, quarantines are so inconvenient, much like mask wearing today. So the quarantine was struck down, and the plague showed its appreciation by spreading rapidly. When Governor Gage stepped in, it made things worse. He did everything he could to suppress the news of the advancing deadly illness, including calling upon his friends in the press to run articles refuting the news coming out of the infected areas, and by threatening to cut off funding to the laboratories that were studying the illness and working to find a way to eradicate it. He also smeared the names of the health officials that were sounding the alarm of what was happening in San Francisco. And he made a secret deal with the federal government that if they would keep quiet about the plague, he would do everything he could to help fight it. As soon as the feds dummied up and stopped talking about it, Gage went back on his word and thwarted their efforts to combat the epidemic. I could do an entire episode on the resentment and mistrust of the Chinese community in San Francisco by non-Asian residents of the city. It had been there from the very beginning. I won't go into detail as they're too extensive. I will only overtly simplify the matter by saying that this outbreak of the plague made things worse. The end result was that too many people died. However, eventually saner minds prevailed, and the outbreak of the bubonic plague was eventually turned around. When the full story was told, it resulted in Governor Gage being booted out of office. Much like corruption, the plague was diminished but never really went away. It would pop up every once in a while, especially during the rebuilding of the city after the 1906 earthquake. By that time, the connection of rats and the plague was understood and accepted, and the widespread eradication of vermin helped considerably. And yet, though the bubonic plague doesn't seem to be posing much of a threat these days, it's still out there, lurking and waiting. Well, don't that just raise a bit of anxiety? And that brings us to the final thing I'd like to bring up about the city by the bay. Because San Francisco sits on a peninsula, there are a lot of people crammed together in a limited amount of space. And when people rub up against each other, it can cause all sorts of societal friction. It can cause the aforementioned anxiety, as well as depression, paranoia, phobias, neuroses, and all sorts of other mental conditions. Sometimes these result in quirky characters like Emperor Norton and Lily Hitchcock Coit. Or they can fester and create serial killers. San Francisco is a storied and colorful history of people that have gone out of the way to kill other people, so much so that the only way I can do true justice in telling the tales of these evil folks is to do so in the next episode. I know that disappoints those that want everything here and now. However, here's a little something to ponder until I fill your ears with the rest of their stories. Much of what I will be telling you will be told in the present tense. This is not ancient history. No, much of this has happened recently, some of it in the here and now. And a number of these murder cases have yet to be solved, their cases are not closed, and the killers might still be out there, lurking and waiting, just like the bubonic plague. Again with the anxiety. And that leads me to the final thought. Though San Francisco is a wonderfully diverse town with, for the most part, a wonderfully tolerant attitude towards others and decent weather, except in the summer, Mark Twain so aptly put that the coldest winter he ever spent was one summer in San Francisco. Though San Francisco can be a great place to live, there are many there that have decided they cannot go on living. San Francisco is below the national average for suicide, and yet the suicide rate is still too high. What I find intriguing are the people that have lost this most private of battles and yet have decided to end it all in the most public of ways. And just about the splashiest way of offing oneself, please forgive the pun, is to jump off of one of San Francisco's iconic bridges. It's interesting to note that there is a great discrepancy between the two main bridges, with more than a 10-to-1 ratio of jumpers preferring to do the deed off of the Golden Gate Bridge. There are many reasons for this, however, I feel it's possible that fewer people take the leap from the Bay Bridge because the idea for that span was conceived by the man who was in many ways San Francisco's patron saint for souls that have lost their way. Back in 1872, San Franciscans quietly chuckled when their favorite eccentric, Joshua Norton, Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico, proclaimed that a bridge should be built across the San Francisco Bay to Oakland. Yes, Emperor Norton came up with the idea for the Bay Bridge. Maybe he wasn't as crazy as people thought. Well, there you go, and there you have it. This has been Abnormalcy. If you've enjoyed this podcast, encourage your friends to listen. And if you didn't enjoy this podcast, encourage your enemies to listen. Just encourage others to listen, because misery loves company. And say, would it kill you to follow Abnormalcy on Twitter or visit the Abnormalcy Facebook page? And if you go to patreon.com and toss some coin our way, you will be rewarded with all sorts of dark joy, including exclusive videos of yours truly telling some personal, murky, and malicious stories. Until next time, I am Todd Robbins. Good night, and good nightmares to you all.